And before, in the yard, we were all talking about them. Didn't you hear us? Why didn't you tell us all you had David's daughters? Harley shrugged and took another bite, taking time to chew and swallow before answering.
Because I thought someone might take them away from me. And I loved them.
But you had no right to keep them. Jacob began to pace. The dampness was turning his skin clammy.
I don't understand.
When I heard their parents died, I decided to take care of them. They were safe with me. And if I listened to all the jabber in the yard, do you think a stick of lumber would ever move?
Custody doesn't work that way, Mr. Harley. You said that someone brought them to you? Who?
Can't say.
Or won't.
Harley had finished his sandwich and was wiping crumbs from his lips with the back of one hand and crumpling the waxed paper, stained brown with mustard, with the other. He seemed oddly calm for a man in his situation.
Can't say as I recognized him. He was all muffled up because of the cold. A do-gooder, I expect. I was so focused on the children that I didn't take notice.
A do-gooder who just happened by your house in the aftermath of the blizzard with two little girls?
He may have said he knew O'Donnell, but I can't remember.
I don't believe you.
Harley waved away this challenge.
It was a blizzard. You know how it was. I was doing my part for the world.
Captain Mantell told me this morning that Emma and Claire were interfered with.
Harley's face crumpled. To Jacob, Harley appeared well and truly crushed. Harley began to shout.
They were interfered with? Impossible. No. How? When? It must have happened that night, the night of the flood after they ran away. That's when anyone could have taken advantage of them. Out on the streets like that, all alone? Anyone? Oh, I'm heartbroken. I adore those girls. Oh, how cruel. But it wasn't me. It wasn't.
You did nothing?
Nothing except care for them.
Was it you who took advantage?
You know me. You know who I am. I took excellent care of them. Surely they know that, and you should too. Surely they'll remember. Surely they'll tell you.
Jacob ignored this appeal.
I need to explain to you that the charges are likely to be steep. Rape, kidnapping, imprisonment. 10 years each, minimum charge. 30 years. That would mean that you would likely die in prison. Since you've already admitted to keeping the sisters, even if you deny the other charges, the jury will extrapolate to the other. I suggest you consider pleading guilty. If you agree, I can probably bargain for a lesser sentence. Of course, a guilty plea means that you admit guilt.
Harley was gaping.
30 years?
Minimum. But there might be other charges added. I've talked only to Mantell. I won't see the district attorney until after he files charges, if he does. Right now I'm going to see whether or not the judge will post bail.
But I didn't touch them. I kept Emma and Claire with me out of the goodness of my heart. I had no idea anyone was looking for them. Everyone knows that orphan asylums are soulless places. I gave them a loving home, I did. I was going to send them to school after they recovered from the shock of losing their parents, but they were still fragile little things. I just wanted to protect them. I was helping them.
30 years, Mr. Harley.
Harley's fretful gaze darted away and back again.
But I didn't do anything to those girls. I love them.
Now, seething with rage after his meeting with the district attorney,
Jacob hesitated outside Harley's cell. Not only had the district attorney dismissed any hope of a plea bargain, but he had also outlined Emma's and the Stipps' depositions, including Mary Stipps' detailed summation of Emma's injuries. He fought to compose himself as the jailer once again handed him a stub of a burning candle. Unlike last time, this time the overseer rose from his bunk to greet him. In the chamois shirt and canvas pants that Jacob had sent to him, Harley looked more like his former commanding self. In the Vanderveer yard, Harley had held exacting standards for neatness, insisting that the rows of lumber were laid out with military precision. And now he had somehow freshened up and appeared to be no longer feverish. Even his bandage, clean and free of discharge, was neatly secured with a square knot. As he had done on his first visit, Jacob handed Harley a bagged sandwich, but Harley tossed it onto the carefully folded blanket at the base of his bed and clutched Jacob by the shoulder.
"Where have you been? No one will tell me anything."
"They are charging you with rape, kidnapping, and imprisonment," Jacob said, "just as I predicted. And no plea bargain. Hoteling won't do it. He wants to make an example of you, though in my opinion a plea bargain is just as good as a case won. However, the nature of the injuries that Emma O'Donnell suffered has persuaded him to pursue this case with a vengeance." Jacob could not erase from his mind Hoteling's recitation of Mary's painstaking catalogue of harm meted out to the girl. There could be no doubt it was rape. It was difficult even to look at Harley now, wondering whether or not he had done it. Pushing his still simmering rage aside, Jacob cast his thoughts ahead to the trial. He'd studied a few rape trial transcripts to evaluate defense strategies. They seemed to consist mostly of heaping shame on the accuser. "Do you wear underclothing under your dresses? Are you sure? Do you ever go without it? Did you that day? How can you remember? What were you doing alone in that part of town? Isn't it true that you have already had relations with other men? Aren't you flirtatious by nature? How long have you been promiscuous? Did you even resist a little? Did you fight to the point of exhaustion? Why not? You seem strong enough to persuade a man that you're not interested, if you really didn't want to, but you really wanted it, didn't you? Did you scream? No? Why not? If you didn't scream, then any reasonable man would take that as leave to do as he pleased. Are you sure you wouldn't rather have a more experienced attorney?" Jacob said, making one last effort to remove himself. A momentary flicker of indecision crossed Harley's face.
"No, I've decided."
Jacob sighed. "Very well." Before the district attorney turned down our request, he shared some information with me. "Since I last saw you, he has interviewed Emma. Just as you claimed, it seems Emma insists that another man, not you, brought them to your house." Harley's gaze lit up.
"But I already told you that, didn't I?"
"But she also says that this other man raped her in your cellar. Repeatedly." Jacob did not mention that Hoteling had summarily dismissed Emma's assertion of another man.
"Unreliable, those sisters," Hoteling had averred. "Not right in the head. They developed a fondness for their kidnapper, Mr. Harley, and in order to survive, excused his misdeeds on the grounds that he was the one who fed and nurtured them. They were making up stories for themselves to keep their sanity from deteriorating. Happens sometimes, you know," he'd continued. "And you can bet that if there were another man, Harley would name him just to get himself freed."
Jacob wondered whether it was possible that Emma had imagined this other man. He supposed that it was possible that a girl as young as Emma could drift into confusion and reverie to cope with horrific circumstances. But he didn't know. He studied Harley's stolid expression for any indication of what the truth might be. Today, Harley had a hurried, practiced air about him,
But Jacob wondered whether his anger with Harley colored his impression of everything the overseer said.
"I swear to you, I didn't touch them," Harley said.
"Tell me the truth. Did you rape Emma?"
"No. Ask her. She'll tell you."
"I plan to." He had sent a note to the Stips yesterday evening, requesting a formal interview with Emma, but he'd not yet heard back.
"Did another man come to the house?"
Harley met Jacob's gaze with the same authority he had commanded in the yard.
"See here. No one raped them. Not at my house. If it happened at all, it happened the night of the flood, when they were out of my care."
Harley sank onto his bench and yanked the sandwich from the bag and began to tear off mouthfuls of bread and meat. Jacob said,
"I need to clarify something else. Was the reason you didn't go to the yard the night of the flood because you went to your house to make certain that Emma and Claire wouldn't drown?"
"That's right,"
Harley said.
"I couldn't leave them to fend for themselves. I had to get them out of the house. Then something hit me, and I don't remember anything after that. Not until I woke up in the hospital."
"But why couldn't they walk out of the house by themselves? You didn't lock them in, did you?"
"I couldn't leave them to their own devices. Children get scared. And about you out there on that ice, I'm sorry about that. I thought I'd make it back in time to help you. I didn't know that I'd get hurt or you'd get stranded."
"Just tell me, Mr. Harley, were Emma and Claire locked in?"
"I needed to keep them safe."
Jacob noted the sidesteps. Harley had not completely denied that there was another man, nor had he denied locking the sisters in.
"How were you injured? Something hit you, you said?"
Harley shook his head.
"I don't know."
"Did Emma hit you with a shovel?"
"A shovel? Emma? Hit me? Why would she do that?"
"Time," the jailer said, peering in through the louvered window in the door.
Jacob had heard nothing of Behan's approach. He had the terrible feeling the man had been eavesdropping outside the cell the whole time.
"Can you give me a few more minutes?" Behan said, "I've got 700 things to do, and being at your beck and call isn't one of them. Time!"
On the way out, Jacob asked the jailer, "Has someone besides the doctor been to see Mr. Harley? His manner is a little, let's say, changed."
"You mean other than Captain Mantell?"
"Captain Mantell?" Behan shrugged, newly reticent.
"Can't say, really. I'm not here 24 hours a day."
"Does the jail keep a visitor's log?"
"Sometimes."
"May I see it?" There were pages and pages of visitors scrawled into the ledger, and very few of the entries were readable. The trick, it seemed, was to answer to the letter of the law, sign something, but not to write legibly enough to have anyone detect your name. Jacob shut the ledger with exasperation and went on to his next appointment. Chapter 35.
The Argus, May 6th, 1879, by Horace Young. Winter Sisters whereabouts confirmed. Emma and Claire O'Donnell, the Blizzard girls, widely believed to be receiving treatment in a sanitarium, are instead living with the doctor's Stip in their home on Madison Avenue. Can this be prudent in light of the injured girl's situation? Especially since it is now known that Dr. Mary Stip finances and provides medical care for ladies of the night at a clinic in downtown Albany. This reporter wonders whether there might be a connection between the assault on the O'Donnell children and Dr. Mary Stipp's immoral activities. Given these vagaries, we pose a third, more important question. Ought any citizen of Albany County patronize the Stipp Clinic from this day forward?
Chapter 36. After leaving Harley at the jail, Jacob had some time before his next appointment, so he went by the lumber district to see how the cleanup was faring. He hadn't been there since the night he'd spent on the roof. The Vanderveer office had withstood the flood's onslaught, but the entirety of the inside had to be torn out and replaced, several broken windows reglazed, and the axed roof patched. 20 carpenters were hard at work while Garrett ran the business from a room he'd rented at the Delavan house. Indeed, the entire lumber district was picking up the pieces, repairing its docks, relaying its trolley tracks, putting its sawmills to rights, and sorting and restacking salvaged lumber wrestled out of rushes miles and miles away. The place was still a bog of mud, though the Hudson had long ago retreated into its channel. Sloops and tugs and dayboats plied the river, and the Erie Canal had reopened to a backlog of packet boats, its infuriated captains losing money by the minute. He met Farrell at the base of State Street, and they veered down Green Street, covering the quarter mile to Harley's house in more time than they would have liked. River silt nearly a foot deep sucked at their boots as they slogged down the center of the road, which was still impassable to wagons. People were slopping mud from their homes with tin buckets and flat shovels, hanging bedding and clothing out to dry on lines strung between tree branches, and tending to steam pumps chugging brown water and more muck onto the already buried cobbles. The air was thick with humidity as the rivulets evaporated into the summer-like air. At Harley's house, a bored policeman, very young and pimpled and hot in his wool uniform, blocked the door.
"Captain Mantell says that no one is to come in."
"No one but police, that is," Farrell said. He jerked his head in Jacob's direction.
"And this one's defending Mr. Harley, so he gets to see everything."
Chastened and newly cooperative, the young officer waved Farrell and Jacob in, reporting that they had pumped out the cellar only that morning with a steam rig borrowed from the Albany brewery, and they ought to be careful because the stairs to the cellar were swollen and slippery. The clapboard house, Jacob noted, was one of the older row houses in the pastures. The newer brick Federalist structure next door was far more elegant, with gabled roofs and dormer windows that Harley's more humble house lacked. Inside, his house reeked of mold and sewage. Heavily tracked river silt sat 6 inches deep in some places. In others, warped floorboards testified to the river's destructive force. The stove flume in the kitchen hung detached from the wall. The modest furniture, a single chair, 2 low tables, lay in splintered pieces up against plaster walls. A waterline reached a foot above the door. Outside, in the narrow alley behind, a wooden privy tilted at a 30-degree angle. The door to the stone cellar stood askew, half off its hinges. Jacob noted a set of keys dangling from its lock. Downstairs, the smell of must and mold in the derelict basement overwhelmed them. It was little more than 20 by 20. One of the cellar walls had partially collapsed, and someone had propped a few 4x4s against the remaining boulders and wedged several more under the ceiling joists. 2 waterlogged mattresses, a ruined couch frame, a Perry coal stove with its chimney intact, a copper tub basin and a shovel had come to sodden rest on the muddied floor. Farrell took hold of the shovel and tagged it with a slip of brown paper. "Orders," he said, "from hotailing." They came up out of the cellar and then climbed a narrow stairway to the second floor. There was only one room under the low eaves. A high, neatly made bed rose 4 feet off the floor. The quilt wasn't even mussed. Harley's shirts and underwear and a second set of bed linens were neatly folded in a chest of drawers. Several pairs of pants hung from nails along one of the walls. Farrell's lips formed a thin line.
"Neatest criminal I ever saw."
"He was careful at the yard, too," Jacob said.
Vanderveer Lumber has the fewest accidents in the district, due entirely to his vigilance.
Farrell touched the counterpane, which was thick with down feathers.
He kept himself comfortable.
Jacob recalled that Harley had only recently bought the house, presumably on monies he had saved from his 20-year tenure at Vanderveer Lumber. But even so, the home seemed more than Jacob imagined Harley could afford. The pastures was a far more expensive area to live in than North Albany, where most of the lumber district laborers resided. The pastures' denizens were small-time merchants and business owners. Perhaps in addition to his propensity toward tidiness, Harley was frugal, too. Though it occurred to Jacob again how little he knew about the man his father set such store by. He leaned against the edge of the bed and looked around the small room. Newly painted. Pristine. Farrell arched his eyebrows at Jacob.
Why such a high bed?
Jacob shrugged.
Get up.
Farrell still held the shovel, and he laid it down. Then he tore off the bedclothes and flipped the mattress onto the floor. Hidden in the bed frame, a hinged wooden box about 6 inches high bore the trademarked oval stamp of Vanderveer Lumber. A handle was built flush into the top. Farrell lifted it. Piles and piles of greenbacks, in neatly tied bundles, lay nestled inside. Farrell let out a low whistle.
You pay him enough for this at the yard?
Jacob shook his head, mentally tallying the fortune before him.
$1,500? $2,000? Grab a pillowcase, Farrell said. I'm going to get that stripling downstairs to come witness this.
Jacob did, and Farrell returned with the stripling, who gaped open-mouthed at the money. Jacob and Farrell began the count. They added up the money twice. It came to $2,150.
A fortune.
Later that night, Jacob searched his father's study, stealthily opening and shutting the many cabinet doors and easing his father's desk drawers in and out with the smooth deftness of a burglar. Methodical and patient, he replaced everything just as he had found it, conscious of his father's acute attention to every detail, noting how similar he and Harley sometimes were. Finding nothing, Jacob carried a lit candle down the stairs and out into the bricked yard and through the stable doors. 6 carriage horses slept in their stalls, their heavy exhalations undisturbed by his intrusion. A heavy canvas tarp covered his father's sleigh, which was set on blocks for the off-season. Jacob set the candle on a shelf and picked up one edge of the tarp, folding it back until he could see inside. On the sleigh's leather seat were the books that Jacob had rescued. He lit 2 oil lamps affixed to the stable wall and sorted the ledgers by date. There were 2 distinct sets, duplicates of one another. His own handwriting, small and precise, filled one, its pages and labeled columns listing monies in and monies out, lumber purchases, sales, payroll, and expenditures for maintenance and upkeep. The second set he had never seen. His father's looping handwriting filled these pages with similar tallies of debits and credits, except that none of the tabulations in the 2 sets of books matched, nor did the source of monies or expenditures. And all his father's entries were coded. Chapter 37. 4 days later, on Saturday, May 10th, William Stipp stepped down from a canary-yellow car of the Old Colony Railroad onto a sand-strewn street in Provincetown, Massachusetts, the tiny fishing village at the far tip of Cape Cod. It was 1 o'clock in the afternoon. A white rush of steam exhaled from the locomotive into a blue sky, already noisy with the cries of seagulls and gannets looping over the shingled shanties of the fishing village. The pungent scents of brine and fish carried on a light breeze from the nearby bay, just out of sight. It had been 2 days of travel from Albany, with an overnight stay in Boston at the United States Hotel, and they were all tired. They was everyone but Mary, who had stayed behind in Albany. In the frantic hours before their departure, they had scurried to pack. Eschewing the services of the meticulous cobbler, Mary had procured shoes from a shop on State Street that sold them ready-made. Amelia had scared up another pair of dresses for the girls from the church box. Elizabeth had helped Vera to drag trunks from the attic, and Harold had been sent to purchase railroad tickets. They had withheld from the girls the reason for their swift departure. On the morning before their hasty retreat, Jacob had come to depose Emma and Claire. Elizabeth had arranged to absent herself. Recently, Madame Hubbard had written to her twice, the first letter expressing exultation at the sisters' resurrection, and the second, desolation. Wouldn't Elizabeth like to come for a visit, to allow Madame Hubbard to offer her comfort? Seizing the excuse, Elizabeth had gone to call on her French teacher at the unreasonable hour of 9 a.m., taking with her one of Vera's strawberry pies as recompense. At the door, Jacob failed to disguise his surreptitious survey of the foyer and hallway, presumably looking for Elizabeth, before he took a seat in the same parlor chair that Hotaling had recently occupied. Jacob looked as if he had not slept. His waistcoat was wrinkled, his unbuttoned shirt cuffs had been rolled back, and his shock of sandy hair had not been combed in some time. Before beginning, he yawned, rubbing his eye sockets with the heels of his hands. Despite his fatigue, however, Jacob flashed them both a dead-eyed certainty, one that William had come to recognize in the war as the life-or-death resolve of the newly fearless. "Before you bring in Emma and Claire," Jacob began, "I want to tell you that I've met with Lansing Hotaling, and he shared the particulars of his interview with Emma and with you. I want you to know that I will not bother her on points of physical intimacy that I believe will only embarrass her." Mary glanced at William. Emma had spoken little in the 2 weeks since the district attorney's bludgeoning visit. It was as if she were just holding on, and despite the rapid healing of her cuts and bruises, she remained withdrawn and lethargic. "If I may, before we go on, did Elizabeth share my letter to her with you?" Jacob said.
"She didn't," Mary said.
"She told you nothing?"
"We're not interested in puzzles, young man," William said. "So why don't you save yourself an interrogation and tell us what you want to say?"
"I fear that all of you may regard me as a traitor. Indeed, I feel a bit of one myself. I said as much in my letter to Elizabeth, though I expect her opinion of me plummeted the moment she learned that I would be defending Mr. Harley. I expect that yours did as well. I want you to understand that my role as Mr. Harley's attorney is not one I sought out."
He stared past them, silent for a moment, his bloodshot eyes watery with fatigue.
"Are you aware that Captain Mantell's first name is Arthur? I haven't figured out who G is yet. I have an idea, though."
"What on earth are you talking about?" William said.
He shook his head, as if to clear it of cobwebs.
"Forgive me. What I mean to say is that I want to assure you that you can trust me."
"You're defending James Harley," William said. "How can we trust you?"
"I mean Emma and Claire no harm. I promise that I will not bolster my defense of Mr. Harley at Emma's expense. Another defense attorney might seek to discredit them or use shame as a tactic, but I will not. Not today, not during the trial. I hold your family in the highest regard. Before I forget, there is one thing I want to warn you about. Be on your guard with Captain Mantell. Take care what you say to him. If you can, avoid him altogether."
William raised his eyebrows, but Jacob would tell them nothing more. Instead, he said,
Have you explained to Emma that she'll be going to court?
They had, in stages. They did not know how much she'd absorbed of what they'd told her, but she seemed to understand that she would have to answer more questions, both now and later. The concepts of a gallery and a judge and jury, however, Emma had greeted with silence.
Do you think she'll be able to testify?
We don't know. She's still not talking much.
There's still 5 weeks before the trial. Do you think she will talk to me today?
We can't say whether Emma will answer any of your questions. Mr. Hotaling terrified her.
Amelia led Emma and Claire in by the hand and sat between them on the long divan, a protective arm around each. Jacob's sharp-eyed gaze turned kind and sympathetic. He said hello in a soft voice and that he was glad to meet them, and most of all that he wanted to help them. He understood, he continued, that they probably didn't want to talk to another stranger like him about the terrible thing that had happened to them. But he wouldn't always be a stranger. He was going to see Emma again at least one more time, in the courtroom. But today, he had only one question for both of them. It was an easy one, but it was an important one, too. They would have to try very hard to remember. And if they couldn't, it would be all right. Would they try? He posed his question, and at first neither Emma nor Claire responded. It was as if they were digging through eternity to find the correct answer. But the question concerned nothing about their bodies, and Emma exhibited none of the reticence she had exhibited with Hotaling. She considered Jacob's question for a time, her brow furrowed as she glanced around her grandmother to Claire, who was waiting for Emma to answer first.
Emma said, "I do remember. It was bright red, like a cherry."
The room stilled. Mary, William, and Amelia gaped at one another. Jacob shut his eyes for a brief moment, and when he opened them, he said,
"Are you sure?"
Emma nodded emphatically. Jacob said,
"Thank you. Now what do you say, Claire?"
Claire nodded in turn.
"Red."
"You're sure? You're not just saying that because that's what your sister said. It's okay if you can't remember."
Claire shook her head solemnly.
"Thank you," Jacob said. "You really helped me. Another time we'll talk again, but not today. I'll wait until everyone feels better."
Mary noted with gratitude that he did not single out Emma as the one who most needed to feel better. Amelia shepherded the girls into the kitchen, and a second shocked silence permeated the room. William and Mary could think of nothing to say.
"It doesn't prove anything by itself," Jacob said, his voice subdued. "It's just one more puzzle piece." "A rather significant one," William said. "What will you do now?"
"What I have been doing.
Mrs. Stipp, I trust you have nothing more to say about Emma's injuries than what you told Mr. Hotaling?"
"No, nothing." There was a knock at the front door, and they could hear Vera padding down the hallway to answer it. She came into the parlor carrying a large crate addressed in neat block letters to Claire and Emma O'Donnell, care of the Doctors Stipp, 714 Madison Avenue, Albany, New York. The package had no return address. William pried open the crate with a crowbar he got from the carriage house. Inside, on a bed of fine paper straw, lay two exquisite dolls, dressed in lavish gowns and wearing pale wigs and fashionable hats. Mary lifted them out, strips of the paper falling to her feet like confetti. They were beautifully made. Each one was almost a foot tall. Their heads were crafted of painted porcelain, and their glass eyes fluttered open and shut. A single envelope dangled from the wrist of one of the dolls,
attached by a scalloped golden ribbon. It was addressed to Emma. Jacob stole it away with a proprietary motion that bordered on violence. He tore the envelope open and read the note out loud. "Do you miss me?" Jacob looked up and said, "Take Emma and Claire to the edge of the world. Don't wait another day. Saratoga isn't far enough, nor is Lake George. Take them somewhere beautiful. Somewhere far, far away, and don't come back until the trial. Tell no one. Not even me, where you've gone." And so, a mere 13 hours later, everyone but Mary had embarked from the Boston and Albany station on Steuben Street on the 2 a.m. express, stealing away in the middle of the night to avoid anyone else taking notice of their abrupt departure. Well-provisioned by Vera with a wicker hamper stuffed with meat pies, bottles of ginger ale, wintered-over apples, a small crock of butter, and two loaves of dark bread, they'd easily endured the six-hour trip to Boston, arriving at 8 o'clock in the morning. They'd checked into the United States Hotel, a titanic utilitarian railroad hostelry that catered primarily to excursionists. From a nearby shop, Amelia purchased Emma and Claire broad-brimmed sun hats in addition to warm coats and gloves, unseasonable items she insisted the sales clerk unearth from a back storage room. Now, at the Provincetown Railroad Depot, William handed their luggage tickets to the porter and turned to help Claire and Emma down the railcar's steep stairs. Amelia followed behind, balancing her small leather valise and the emptied hamper in one hand and gripping the handrail with the other. She turned to lend Elizabeth a hand, but Elizabeth skimmed down the three steps without any help. She carried a new violin in a cheap case made of pine wood that William had purchased for her in Boston. When he had discovered at the station in Albany that Elizabeth had not brought her own instrument, out of fear that the sea air would damage it, he told her that while she might be willing to sacrifice the progress she had made, he was not. In Boston, he asked after reputable violin makers and was directed to St. Botolph Street, an hour horse car ride away. He purchased an inexpensive one over the protestations of its maker, who argued that no one should choose a violin except the person who was going to play it. "They are cherished beings," he'd claimed, "like children, and to select one for someone without their approval was tantamount to committing a crime." But Elizabeth was thrilled. Emma and Claire had never been to the sea. William hired a hack to carry their luggage from the depot to their hotel, and a second one to carry all of them. The road to the hotel ran past the harbor. The wind was up, and the whip of sail and rope filled the air. A dozen sailing sloops and schooners rode at anchor. Dories, trawlers, cutters, and dinghies crowded a long dock, extending 100 feet into the glimmering bay. At the dock's far end, a steamship was loading day passengers for the bumpy trip back to Boston. It was delicious to watch Emma and Claire gasp at the vibrant scene. Delicious to catch them forgetting, even for a moment, the stone walls of that cellar. It was 8 weeks since the blizzard, 2 since the flood. They had buried Emma and Claire, and now they were alive. In Boston, when they had asked where to stay, the concierge had said, "Provincetown? Why are you going there now? It's all Portuguese fishermen and sand and herring. But if you must, there's a new hotel for the tourist trade." The Whaler's Rest was a shingled 2-story inn with a long covered veranda that faced the sea. This early in the season, the inn abounded with vacancies, and they were assigned choice rooms on the second floor overlooking the endless bay and its strip of shell-pebbled beach. 2 rooms connected through an interior door. Amelia and Emma took one side, and Elizabeth and Claire the other. William's corner room down the hall was full of light, and furnished with a single bed, made up with a white bedspread and 2 bright blue pillows. Do you miss me? William shuddered at the memory. He hoped that Provincetown would be far enough away to keep Emma and Claire from harm, but he didn't know. He might have suggested getting out of town anyway. Horace Young's relentless newspaper articles had stirred up the city so much that none of them could go anywhere without being stared at, which was one of the other reasons why he had hated to leave Mary behind, vulnerable to every curious stare or passerby. He had wanted to be the one to keep the clinic going, to save her that indignity, but soon after they had begun packing, a letter arrived for her, the libelous newspaper articles having done swift work. Dr. Mary Stipp. In light of developments recently brought to our collective attention, as well as information that you have been performing abortions at a private clinic, you are invited to report on May 12th at 1 o'clock in the afternoon to Albany City Hospital for examination of the terms of your medical staff appointment to this hospital. Please reply at your earliest convenience to this summons. However, please note that should you be unable to attend, said meeting will proceed without you. Any and all decisions made will be binding and indissoluble. The Examination Committee, Albany City Hospital. During the war, in the midst of falling shells and dying men, Mary had not shown as much fury as she did when reading that letter aloud to him. "Rumors," she railed. "Who started them? It is unconscionable." Never once in the chaos of Antietam had William worried about Mary, but he worried now. The convoluted prejudices of a committee could be far more sinister than the brutality of artillery. He went to the window. Outside, Claire and Elizabeth were climbing down a set of wooden stairs to the beach. Claire smiled at Elizabeth from underneath the wide brim of her sun hat, and Elizabeth bent low to kiss her cheek. William went down the hall and knocked on Amelia and Emma's door. Emma was in bed, her back to the open door, a small figure curled up under a white candlewick bedspread. Amelia, reading a book, looked up at William and shook her head. Mary had performed one last exam on Emma before they left. Amelia had held her hand and distracted her with stories, having learned that trick from Elizabeth. Luckily, no sign of venereal infection had manifested itself. Mary removed the stitches and declared Emma physically healed, completely able to undertake the trip. And even if no doll had ever made its way to their door, it had grown abundantly clear that while Emma's body had healed, her mind had not. A place to disappear to, a place to regain her strength, a place where Emma and Claire could venture outside without anyone knowing who they were, was a good idea in any case. William shut the door quietly. Were they expecting too much of a fishing village and a cheery hotel? Perhaps. Chapter 38. In the amphitheater operating room of City Hospital, Dr. Mary Stipp sat beneath the bright pendant gaslight that illuminated the surgical arena. The surgery bed had been pushed against the wall. The 10 members of the examination committee occupied the 2 front rows of the theater, the customary province of observing medical students. The physicians constituted the governing staff that oversaw the medical affairs of the hospital, in addition to granting and revoking admitting privileges. This afternoon, their general demeanor was one of censure, though their individual greetings to Mary had betrayed no hostility. As usual, the operating theater was cold, kept frosty to slow patient bleeding during surgery. How many surgeries had she done in this room? 1, 2 a week? 100, at least. It smelled strongly of antiseptic. The committee president, Thomas Hun, adjusted his pince-nez on his long nose as he read through a sheaf of papers on his lap. Mary thought the elderly Hun austere and smugly upright. As current dean of faculty at the Albany Medical College and former president of the Albany Medical Society, he had for years denied Mary entry to the society's ranks, just as a prior dean had once denied her admission to the college. The vice chair of the committee, Samuel Ward, had been a medical cadet in the war, but of the rest, she counted only Albert Vanderveer an ally. Mary studied Samuel Ward's fine, impassive face. He kept his gaze trained on Hun, as one would a general, thereby distancing himself from the soldier being disciplined. "The committee has received several complaints," Hun began, finally looking up. He was a deacon at St. Peter's Church, and on Sunday he was famous for reading the liturgy in a thin, quiet voice so that parishioners had to listen carefully. "In fact, I have a list, which I will read for the benefit of all. Maintains secret unsanitary private clinic for treatment of ladies of the night, which thereby aids and abets prostitution. As yet undetermined possible further connection with said profession. Neglect of duty. Performs abortions." He removed his pince-nez and dangled the glasses from a speckled hand that had probed innumerable patients over his 50 years of practice. "What say you, Dr. Stipp, to these charges?" Mary stifled an impulse to raise her voice. "I beg your pardon, Dr. Hun, but am I in a court of law? Charges? Aids and abets? Perpetrates?"
"You understand the purpose, I presume, of this committee?"
Hun waved his glasses at the silent cohort seated with him.
"We certify competency in our medical staff. Any medical appointment is subject to review. When a member of the staff is publicly questioned about his, forgive me, her medical practice, it becomes a concern. Staff appointments are not tenured. They can be withdrawn for any reason this committee deems valid."
"Fine," Mary said. "I'll explain, though I shouldn't have to. I established the private clinic as a haven to serve those women that neither this hospital nor any other in town will treat. In fact, this hospital has refused to treat many such women on many occasions."
"We have a budget for the indigent."
"You know very well that it does not extend to the treatment of women of a certain class. No, let me be more specific. To the treatment of prostitutes." The collective committee, with the exception of Albert Vanderveer, winced. Mary continued, "They are regularly turned away, especially in the aftermath of an abortion.
At this hospital, we do not condone immorality."
"When they are bleeding to death, in pain, on death's door."
"Answer the last charge, Dr. Stipp," Hun said. "It is the most egregious of the four. In that clinic of yours, do you perform abortions?"
"I do not. That is a savage rumor fomented to discredit me. But I never turn away a woman who has been harmed by one."
"It is the same thing."
"It is not. Hospitals refuse to treat prostitutes even for rape."
"No prostitute is raped."
"That is impossible. They are raped. Often. And attacked. It's a hazard of their profession. As is venereal disease." The men scoffed, and Mary wondered how a purported investigation into rumors had so quickly devolved into what defined the rape of a prostitute. "Do you know what I do at my clinic? The exact things that each of you does every day for your patients. I treat their tonsillitis, stitch up their wounds, and ease the ravages of disease. I deliver their babies. I take care of them. Hun sniffed and tented his hands.
Naturally, as a woman of peculiar liberality, you are sympathetic to these disreputable causes.
Tonsillitis in a child is a disreputable cause? He ignored her.
But our purpose today speaks to respectability and your fitness as a member of this staff. City Hospital has a reputation to uphold. It has long been the view of this committee, frankly, since you were first admitted, that your status has always been provisional. It was our belief that your husband would intervene should you stumble. However, both of you operated on Mr. Harley, and considering that the man is now charged with the ravishment of one of those sisters, it was a gross conflict of interest that I am surprised you undertook, given your demonstrated affection for the O'Donnells and your many efforts to recover them. We are all, therefore, shocked that you would give aid and comfort to the man who attacked them. And that is a baseless charge, and you know it, Mary said.
Neither William nor I had any idea that Mr. Harley had been involved in the kidnapping of Emma and Claire O'Donnell. Had we known and had time, we would have called in another physician, as was since done. Albert Vanderveer has stepped in, as I am certain you are also aware. She tilted her head at Albert, who acknowledged her with a brief nod. However, in any case, the time required to obtain alternate assistance that chaotic night would have compromised Mr. Harley's already precarious physical condition. Only my husband and I and Albert Vanderveer reported to the hospital that night, and Dr. Vanderveer had already gone home when Mr. Harley arrived. Where were all of you, by the way?
Please hold your commentary until I am finished speaking, Hun said. We also heard from our head nurse, Miss Mueller, that you were late on your rounds of Mr. Harley the day after you treated him.
Emma and Claire had just arrived and needed care,
thus allowing Mr. Harley to be spirited away and putting him at greater harm.
It is preposterous to hold me accountable for that. He was taken away without my consent or knowledge.
If you had not been derelict in your duty, then you would have been here and thus could have prevented that unfortunate development. No matter what the man's offense, he deserved good medical treatment. His life was put at risk, we understand.
As are prostitutes put at risk when they are denied care. Hun forestalled her with a raised hand.
Despite our many points of difference with you, and despite the fact that few of us consider a woman fit to do the work of a physician, we, the committee, recognize that given your prior profession as a midwife, your sympathies cannot fail to fall naturally into the arena of womanhood. Today, you have also denied performing abortions. And though I, personally, am not yet entirely persuaded, we lack evidence. You will therefore be pleased to learn that I have decided that we will renew, provisionally, your appointment here to City Hospital, under the condition that you treat females only, for female problems, with the caveat that you desist in caring for prostitutes. The reputation of the hospital is at stake. Charitable impulses are to be lauded, but not immoral ones.
He sniffed again, satisfied with himself.
I think you will find this ruling more than generous.
He offered this compensation prize as he would a box of fine chocolates. To his right and left, his fellow physicians hunched blank-faced, giving nothing away of their own opinions on the subject of Hun's supposed benevolence.
"I am a medical doctor," Mary said, "educated and experienced. I am careful, prepared, diligent. I have met every criterion of our profession, and will continue to do so for as long as I choose to practice. I will treat whomever I wish to treat, regardless of gender or background or societal caste."
"I thought as much," Hun said, gathering his papers. "Of course, you may do as you like privately, but you will no longer be associated with this hospital. Your appointment to City Hospital is terminated."
"You understand that my patients will suffer if I do not have access to the surgery.
You should have considered that before you refused our olive branch. You may, of course, always refer them to any one of us here, or to your husband."
"He also operated on Mr. Harley, if you'll remember. And yet you do not investigate him?"
Hun rose.
"This investigation is now concluded."
One by one, her former colleagues filed from the surgery. Albert Vanderveer put a hand on her shoulder, but she shook it off. She wondered how long they had all been waiting to expel her from the hospital's physician roles. She gathered her things and exited the hospital through the accident ward. Outside on the street, under a street lamp, Captain Mantell was talking with Dr. Hun. Mantell caught her eye, a flicker of triumph on his face. At her downtown clinic, Mary attacked the accumulation of dust and dirt, mopping the floors and chasing away the roaches with buckets of water. She had forgotten her apron, and when she straightened, she wiped her hands on her splattered dress. She loved these grim walls, the blistering work that chapped her hands, the raw humanity that walked through her doors. 3 years she had spent here, once a week, caring for women who might now be her only patients. She had no idea what would happen to her other practice once the news got out that she had been dismissed from the hospital. It was a Monday, not a Thursday, but she lit the lantern to hang outside anyway. When she opened the door, she was shocked to find Viola Vanderveer on the doorstep, looking out of place in the dank alleyway. She was dressed in a fine blue gown that emphasized her tiny waist. Mary recognized Bonnie's fine handiwork in Viola's elaborate hat, decorated with ostrich feathers and a hummingbird perched in a nest of twigs. This was the second time an overdressed Vanderveer had made an unannounced appearance at her clinic, and both times she'd been shocked to see them.
"Jacob told me you might be here," Viola said. "May I come in?"
Mary opened the door wide to admit her, then hung the lantern outside in its usual spot. Viola edged past her, lifting the hem of her gown to keep it from dragging in the puddles of mop water pooling on the uneven floor. Inside, she turned, taking in the musty clinic, betraying no surprise. "It isn't much, but my patients feel safe coming here. Until recently." "Would you like to sit?" Mary said, indicating one of the wooden armchairs stacked in a corner. Viola waved away the offer.
"I'm sorry for the unannounced visit, but I have long wanted to see you in person to say how sorry I am about Bonnie's daughters. I'm heartbroken about what happened."
She pulled nervously at the tips of her calfskin gloves.
"I would have called on you, but I wasn't certain how you would have felt, given our family's connection with Mr. Harley."
"I would have been grateful."
"I probably shouldn't even be speaking to you."
Restless, she began to walk about the room.
"No doubt there is some legal prohibition banning it, and they're maligning all of us in the papers. This morning, that terrible Horace Young pointed out the impropriety of Jacob defending Mr. Harley. Not that I wanted Jacob to do it, but the truth of it is that we are all pariahs now. No one, it seems, will win in this situation.